this is Chief Judge Janet DeFiore. Over the past few months, the Gender Fairness Committee of the 3rd Judicial District, chaired by former Albany City Court Judge Rachel Kretzer, has produced a documentary about the pioneering women judges of the 7-county 3rd Judicial District. 9 groundbreaking judges were interviewed. Mae D'Agostino, judge of the United States District Court for the Northern District of New York; Catherine Doyle, former surrogate of Albany County; Victoria Graffio, former judge of the New York Court of Appeals; Helena Heath, judge of the Albany City Court; Rachel Kretzer, former judge of the Albany City Criminal Court; Karen Peters, the presiding justice of the Appellate Division 3rd Department; Beverly Tobin, former judge of the Albany County Family Court; Mary Work, former surrogate of Ulster County; and Deborah Young, judge of the Rensselaer County Court. Throughout the month of March, Women's History Month, we will share these interviews through our Amici podcasts. I think you will find the interviews of these trailblazing women to be both enlightening and inspiring.
I think many people underestimate to what extent people bring their personal philosophy and life experiences to cases. And I think that's true whether you're on the trial bench or whether you're on the appellate bench. Judges are still people. They have their own value systems. They have their own professional experiences. They have their own life experiences. And I think somehow that's the lens through which they examine the facts of a case. And so when you have people of different economic backgrounds, different ethnic, racial, gender, whatever, I think that it brings a different richness to the discussion.
Welcome to Amici, news and insight from the New York judiciary and the unified court system. I'm John Carr. Today's program is the third in a series of pioneering women judges in the 3rd Judicial District. Today we feature former Court of Appeals Judge Victoria Graffio. Judge Graffio was the first woman in the 3rd Judicial District to ascend to the highest court in the state. You heard a snippet of her interview at the outset. Here's the rest. In the biography you wrote for the Historical Society, you talked about your grandmother, and there was a quote that jumped out at me about the role of women in my family and the impact they had on my development. Can you tell us that story, and particularly about the influence of your grandparents and the suffragist grandparent?
Sure. My grandmothers were immigrants from Italy. And so they had a great influence on me because most of the women in my family worked outside the home. And so I grew up knowing that I had to decide on something that I wanted to do to help support myself and the family. But also, my mother's mother, I think, was one of the role models that I had growing up. She worked in a garment industry with women from different ethnic backgrounds, and they would work together to help each other with their problems. And she was very involved in community organizations. She was a real leader, despite the fact that she only went to primary school for a few years, so she had virtually no formal education. She had gone to work at 10 in the garment industry in Manhattan. And she always told us about how proud she was that she marched with the suffragettes. So I think we had kind of a family history of strong women in our Italian family, and we were kind of expected to follow that lead.
I wonder how old your grandmother was when she was allowed to vote.
You know, I don't know that question. I lost my grandmother before I graduated law school, so there are a lot of topics I wish I had discussed with her as an adult that I didn't think to ask as a young person.
No, don't we all? Let's fast forward a little bit to the mid-70s, and you were a student here and hoping to get some practical experience. And what did you encounter? Were there many women litigating in Albany at that time, or were the firms responsive, receptive to women applicants?
I came to Albany Law School in 1974. The two classes ahead of mine, we were the class of 77, had very few women. Our class had a larger number of women. We were maybe, I'm going to guess, about 40 women, perhaps. Not all of those women graduated, and the class was over 200. So it was kind of on the cusp of women starting to enter the legal profession. There were very few female litigators in the Capital District. There were maybe a couple in the district attorney's office. But for the most part, the firms in Albany, women pretty much did estate and trust, family law, that type of thing. There were not as many civil litigators. So I decided that the only way I was going to end up with a job in a law firm was if I started to work in a law firm while I was a student, that if they got a chance to get to know me, that perhaps I'd be offered a job. So my second and third year, I worked for a firm in Colony, and that turned into a full-time job upon graduation. Although I did do other interviewing, and it was rather shocking, some of the questions that were posed.
Such as?
I remember interviewing with a firm in Utica. They asked me if I had a boyfriend, if I planned on getting married, if I thought I was going to get pregnant, and what were they going to do if I got pregnant shortly after they hired me. And at that time, I was single and didn't have a boyfriend, so I wasn't even sure why I was being asked these questions. But, you know, it was a different era. It was firms were not as accustomed to having women, and they were unaware of how to balance that family work responsibility that many women have to carry.
And after you graduated, you went to Tate Bischko?
Yes. When I graduated, I went to work for a firm with 9 gentlemen in Colony, New York. And I was extremely fortunate. They were great mentors. They taught me the practice of law, and they gave me a lot of opportunities. And I started trying cases shortly after I was admitted to the bar. So they were very fair and equitable about the distribution of work in the office.
Were you the first and only woman there?
Yes.
Wow. And I think I've heard this story before, but could you tell the story about the federal bank case you had and the opposing counsel referred to you as his little lady, little friend, little something or other?
Well, those were in the mid to late 70s. It was interesting to be a female litigator because many of the judges in the Capital District had never presided over a trial with a female attorney. So I remember one evening going to a justice court up north, and my brother had gone with me that night because it was a very terrible snowstorm. And that judge kept asking me if I was really a lawyer and who he could call to make sure I was an attorney. And after making us sit there for about 2.5 hours, my brother finally blurted out, "Do you think we'd be sitting here all night if she wasn't a lawyer?" But I had an equal access to credit trial in Rensselaer County in federal court, and my adversary was a retired judge who kept calling me his little friend. And I did voice some objection to that in chambers, but I don't think he was admonished too much about it. But the judge said to me, "Well, what should we call you?" I said, "Well, my name would be fine, or counselor would be fine." So, you know, there wasn't a lot of experience in how to deal with women in the courtroom back then.
Was that in front of a jury?
That trial did have a jury, and so that was my concern with the perception. And actually, at one point, one of the jurors strolled into the courtroom while I was working at counsel's table, and he said to me, "Oh, are you that little girl who's trying this case?" And that's when I realized that the words you use in the courtroom do have an impact on jurors. So it was, I think all young attorneys have difficulty in the courtroom when you're up against experienced attorneys, but it was particularly difficult at that period of time because the system was not accustomed to women practicing.
So then, as I recall, Tate Bischko disbands, and you go to the predecessor of Oasis, I believe, Division of Alcoholism and whatever it is, where you work with and meet, coincidentally, Karen Peters, right?
Yes. When my law firm disbanded, I decided that I was probably interested in starting my own practice. But until I was organized to do that, I thought a stint in government might be helpful. And I happened to see an ad in the Women's Bar newsletter about a position at the New York State Division of Alcoholism and Alcohol Abuse. And since I had done a fair amount of matrimonial litigation, I understood some of the effects of alcoholism on family relationships, so I thought I would apply for that position. And I was interviewed and hired by Karen Peters, who was counsel of the agency at the time. And she became also a very effective mentor, and she pretty much taught me the ropes for how you succeed in a large bureaucracy, because prior to that, obviously, we were a smaller firm. And she also had the courage to run for Supreme Court, the first woman in the 3rd Judicial District. So I think that her success at that effort years later was an encouragement for me to consider also a judicial career.
She may have also been the first family court judge in Ulster County, first female family court judge before Supreme Court.
She probably was.
But that was an inspiration for you,
yes,
judicial career.
Judge Peters is a very inspiring person, and she has, I think, spent a great deal of her time and effort in encouraging other women in the legal profession.
Your next stop, I think, is a legislative branch, where you ended up, I think, for, 10 years?
Yes.
Did you experience or witness any gender discrimination issues?
On the one hand, I think my 10 years in the legislature, in some respects, was the most exciting and interesting of my various legal careers. Because you're dealing with cutting-edge public policy issues. As a political science major, I was always interested in government. On the other hand, at times it could be frustrating because, first of all, I worked for the Assembly minority, so we had to struggle for resources and for attention and for a legislative agenda. But also there were not many women at the upper echelon of staff in the legislature at that time. Initially, when I was chief counsel to Assembly Minority Leader Clarence D. Rappelier, and we would have leaders' meetings, I would be the only woman in the room. So for a good part of my career, I worked with all men. And I'm comfortable doing that. But it's interesting as I reflect back that I always seem to be in these positions until I entered the appellate division and the Court of Appeals. I was generally, the executive staff was all male.
Did they treat you equally in legislature?
Well, my boss was terrific. I don't know how some of the other conferences operated, but I can honestly say my members had a lot of trust in me. I developed a lot of close relationships. It was a very successful professional experience for me. So I think that I was able to bring more women and advance more women on our staff. And a lot of those people ended up in very substantial government positions as years went by. So it was a very fulfilling period of my career.
And it sounds like a lot of that had to do with the fact that Rapp was receptive to that. I mean, if he wasn't, that would have been the end of the discussion, wouldn't it?
Well, I'll tell you one story. And this is how I gained respect very early on for my employer. One of the first years that I was there in January when the new members arrive in Albany, they had a reception at the Fort Orange Club, which at that time excluded female members. And I refused to attend. So I went in and talked to the leader and told him that I was uncomfortable going there. They didn't allow female members, that our Women's Bar Association was petitioning them to accept women members. And so my leader said, all right, after this, we will not hold these events there. So I thought that that was very gracious, and also, but he truly understood and appreciated that once it was brought to his attention.
Great. Then you go up from there to the Attorney General's office as you went in as Solicitor General, didn't you?
Yes, I did.
Were you the first female in that position?
No. The Attorney General's office had actually a very long tradition of female solicitors. There were a couple of women before me. So, you know, that's one thing in government service. For many years and many decades, I think that government was a more satisfying home for a lot of women because there were more opportunities for women. And my short stint at the AG's office was probably the first time that I worked with as many lawyers. I had not had that opportunity prior to that for that many female colleagues.
And at that time, there was probably a fair number of women in the Attorney General's office, wasn't there?
Yes. There were, there were quite a number of women in the various offices around the state.
And then I imagine you had to resign to run for Supreme Court?
Yes, I had. I resigned in August and was appointed in September.
How were you positioned to get that appointment? That it was an interim appointment, wasn't it, until the next election? Is that how it worked?
Yes. Well, I never seriously considered a judicial run. I think some people perhaps plan for years and think they want to be a judge. I was quite happy doing what I was doing, and I had only been there about 2 years. And I received a phone call from my county chairman, my Republican county chairman, asking me if I would consider running for Supreme Court. So I don't know if you would call that I was solicited for it, but it was something that I hadn't given a great amount of thought to because I had always enjoyed my jobs. And I was called to a meeting and sat down and spoke with them, and lo and behold, I ended up one of the three women. It was a very unusual campaign. There were three vacancies, and the Republican Party ran three women, a sitting family court judge and a sitting district attorney, and I did not have the name ID of the other two women, and we ran against three incumbent Democratic judges. So it was a very, I think, unusual election. It was a rather unique strategy to put female candidates in front of the electorate to see if the electorate was amenable to women on the bench and the need for more diversity on the bench. At that time, Judge Peters was on the appellate division, so there was no woman on the Supreme Court bench in the seven counties. And that was a theme of the campaign. So it was, an exciting time to run. It was a big risk for me because out of six candidates, I figured I had the least amount of name ID, and I had to resign a great job in order to do this. I was appointed to fill the vacancy. The judge who had that position had been appointed to the federal court, so that's how the vacancy in Albany County occurred. So I went in September and filled the vacancy, but I had to run that November for the term beginning in January.
How did you become known, though, to the powers that be to be in a position to get that appointment for Judge Kahn's seat?
Well,
and to get nominated for the to run.
There are so many different ways that people become a judicial candidate. I think mine was probably a bit unusual in that I came out of government, whereas most judicial candidates up to that point in time in the third JD tended to be out of private practice, or even more likely, they had been judges in lower courts, and then they were moved up the ranks, whether city, county, even town justices, and then they ran for Supreme Court. So mine was a rather unique path. But I was very fortunate in that I had worked in the government/political arena for years, and I knew people in the political arena, and I think that was quite a benefit for me.
You mentioned that at the time that you went to Supreme Court, Judge Peters was on the appellate division, so there
yes.
were no women in the trial court.
Correct.
Did you have any pause about going to the appellate division 2 years later, knowing that that would return the trial court to all male?
I think when Supreme Court judges think about applying for the appellate division, whether male or female, they always wonder about the effect it's going to have on their local bar. Many of my colleagues on the appellate division would talk about how they lamented over this because many are the only Supreme Court judge in their county. So when you go to the appellate division, you leave the bar without a local justice. So I had the additional concern that there wouldn't be any women on the trial bench in the third JD. But on the other hand, you hope that whoever the parties decide to run the next time, that maybe there would be a qualified female candidate. So at a certain point, you have to realize some of these opportunities are only presented once to you, and you do what you think is best for your career, and at the same time, you hope that the tradition can continue.
So at the appellate division, there was you and Judge Peters. Judge Michael was gone by then, wasn't she?
No, when I first joined the appellate division, I was the third woman because Judge Ann Michael from Buffalo was on the court, and of course Judge Peters was on the court.
Okay. Let's turn to the Court of Appeals. When Judge Kay was appointed in 83, did you grasp the significance of that at that time?
I think all female attorneys had a sense of pride when Judith Kay joined the New York Court of Appeals. It was a confirmation that we were making an impact on the profession. And for me personally, I had argued a case around 1980 at the Court of Appeals. And I remember standing at the podium and looking at the seven men. And of course, as a young lawyer, you're rather nervous anyway, your first argument in the Court of Appeals. But I remembered just thinking, there's all these gentlemen here. And of course, all the portraits around the courtroom were all male too. So it would be impossible not to feel a bit out of place there. So I think that Judith's appointment to the court was such a significant advancement for all women in the profession.
Now, she was the only one for 10 years, maybe, before Judge Shapiro joined her. And then you were the third.
Yes.
And then within a couple of years, you had a majority.
Yeah, well, Judge Kay was always very proud of the fact that for a number of years we had four women on the court. And so at least when the court undertook its major renovation, we actually got an additional bathroom outside the courtroom, so we had a men's and a ladies' room. These things are symbolic of equality.
Beyond symbolism, why is it important to have diversity, gender, racial, whatever, on an appellate court? I mean, theoretically, you apply facts of the law, and bingo, you have a decision. Is there something that different experiences bring to the appellate process that's important to have there?
I think many people underestimate to what extent people bring their personal philosophy and life experiences to cases. And I think that's true whether you're on the trial bench or whether you're on the appellate bench. Judges are still people. They have their own value systems. They have their own professional experiences. They have their own life experiences. And I think somehow that's the lens through which they examine the facts of a case. And so when you have people of different economic backgrounds, different ethnic, racial, gender, whatever, I think that it brings a different richness to the discussion. I spent 14 years on the Court of Appeals. I can only remember two cases. I could be incorrect about this, but I only remember two cases in which all the women voted one way and all the men voted another. And neither was the type of case you would expect that. One was a case out of Delaware, a commercial corporate case. So I think when it actually comes to the analysis, it's not reflected that there's a gender difference. But I do think that diversity helps the court to have a better grasp of the landscape of society in our state. I think that was true also geographically. There's great differences in practice between, say, Manhattan and the North Country or Western New York or the Southern Tier. So there's all kinds of different forms of diversity that are, I think, very significant in keeping a balanced and fair judiciary. And that's all besides the fact that it helps to instill confidence in the courts. You know, people are so critical now of the various branches of government, especially the representative arm of government. People tend to think it doesn't function the way it should function. I think that it's important for the judiciary, for people to believe that it's a fair and just system. That's just critical, I think, for our system of democracy. And people, I think, gain a certain degree of confidence if they feel they're at times able to look at someone that looks like them or who they know their background is somewhat similar to. They feel that at least perhaps that person has a better understanding of where they're coming from. So I think that that's all very critical.
You left the court at the end of 2014, and then I think shortly thereafter went to Harris Beach. How, from a gender perspective, how is life different from a female attorney now in a private firm than it was in the mid-70s when you were at Tate Bischoff?
Well, there's still a lot of challenges for women in private practice. Not so much, I think, in your immediate work environment. I'm very fortunate at Harris Beach. I have a wonderful work environment, and I have a lot of opportunities at that firm. But we have been talking about the fact internally at the firm, and also there's a lot of academic and legal writings about the fact that it's still more difficult for women to bring in business, especially in large firms. We still have not seen anything near to the increase in numbers of female equity partners in law firms, either in New York or the United States, for what you would expect, considering what percentage of the bar we now constitute and the fact that most law schools have 50% or more female students. We still have very small numbers when it comes to law firm leadership across the nation. So there's still a lot of issues for women to deal with, how to balance family and work, how to be able to bring in business, be a rainmaker, because the truth is the practice of law is a business. So I think that's probably the same type of glass ceiling issues that you see in corporate America and where women are trying to have better representation on boards and in management of corporations. I think law firms are trying to see what they can do now to encourage more women. First of all, we have a problem with retention of women in private practice and minorities, I would mention as well. You know, in order to keep diversity, law firms need the same extent of diversity that we talk about for the judiciary. And so I think most law firms are trying to figure out how do we better retain the young lawyers who we're training and how do we help them to be successful so that they can progress to positions of leadership in the firms in decades to come, in years to come.
Two follow-ups. One, retaining them. Where are they going?
Well, there's a lot of studies about that. Some female associates will be offered positions in-house. That's true of either gender. Some, the demands are just perhaps the scheduling. I haven't really seen any. There are studies that try to ask. I mean, I think most law firms do exit interviews and they try to determine why some people are leaving. I think a lot has to do with lifestyle. There's different expectations now. A lot of younger lawyers perhaps don't want to work 60, 70 hours a week, or they don't want the travel that's involved. I think it's all very personal.
And I'm also intrigued, and this is something we hadn't heard before, the rainmaking issue. What is the impediment to women becoming the type of rainmaker they need to bring business into a law firm?
Well, law firms value different aspects of practice, but certainly the ability to attract new business is one of the primary components of being able to move up the ladder in any law firm, regardless of the size. So women have to be able to market themselves. They have to be able to service the client's work, instill that sense of confidence in the client, and be able to develop that relationship with the client to be able to maintain that business and to grow that business. And that's not an easy thing for any young lawyer to learn, but I think it can be especially difficult for young women because they're not as accustomed to selling their skills and abilities.
There's a new crop of prospective female attorneys now in law school or maybe now in kindergarten. What do you want them to know about the path that's been cleared for them and the responsibilities they have to take this to a new frontier?
I think that prospective law students and also young attorneys have to remember that we are a helping profession and that what's important is really to establish a really fine reputation. You still need the basic components of being a good lawyer, which is, you know, to be responsible, conscientious, hard work, good communication skills, writing and verbal skills, and to be trustworthy. And that reputation begins as a student and then carries through to your career, because many of the people who you're going to meet in college and law school, you're going to interconnect with them at some later point in your life. So reputation is a lifelong aspect, I think. And I think a lot of young people, especially because of the technology that we now have, they're not quite as conscious of that in terms of Facebook and all the other types of social media that's out there that is later going to have an impact on their reputation. So I think that young people need to realize that what you do now can have ramifications 10 years down the road. So that's something that we didn't quite experience when I was growing up, but I think that's a more difficult aspect for young people to begin to formulate their behavior so that they can pursue a successful career later on.
Can you discuss how the trailblazers that preceded you, going from Kate Stoneman to Judith Kaye to Sandra O'Connor and Karen Peters, made it possible for you to achieve what you did?
Well, I think if you didn't have these women who received a fair amount of attention for their achievements, well-deserved achievements, and beyond that, they did a fantastic job once they achieved those positions, which I think is critical. You always feel a heavy responsibility when you know you're one of the firsts or second or third or whatever, that you want other women to be able to follow your path. So you know that you have to work twice as hard as perhaps you see some of your colleagues, just because you know that you carry this responsibility and you want others to be able to follow in your footsteps. So I think what that does is it helps to instill a sense of possibility in the next generation. You know, if she can do it, perhaps I should think about doing that. I think mentoring is extremely important. I never considered going to law school. It wasn't something that I had thought was possible. I went to college to be a high school history teacher, but I was very fortunate. I had several professors who called me in and talked to me and said, you really should consider graduate school. Whether you go to graduate school for history or you go to law school, you should really think about graduate school. And I had not really contemplated that because my parents were not college educated. I was the first one in my dad's family to even go to college. That was a big enough financial burden for us. I had never considered graduate school. And from the encouragement that I received from my professors, I decided that I would apply. I was student teaching in at Norwich High School when my law school acceptances arrived. And the first person I talked to was my supervising teacher. And I said to him, I have this dilemma. I really enjoy teaching, but now I have these acceptances at law school. And he encouraged me to go to law school. He said, you can always come back and apply for a teaching job, but why don't you try this? So I think we all need sometimes a little push, and I was the beneficiary of that kind of little bit of shot of confidence from mentoring. And so I think it's very important to mentor other young people and to return that gift.
Wonderful. What were your thoughts on going into law school? Did you have an idea at that point what kind of law you wanted to practice?
No, at that time, my family didn't know any attorneys. There weren't attorneys in our neighborhood. We weren't in that social circle. I just knew what I saw on television, so I figured I wanted to be a trial lawyer. I really didn't know there was much else out there at the time, which I don't think was unusual for people that weren't sure what it was. I just felt that the law gave you an opportunity to make a difference, to have your voice heard, to help people, and that was what attracted me to it. And I thought, well, if I didn't enjoy it, I'd be able to go back to my previous career. So I didn't think I had too much to lose other than the tuition.
That's terrific. What else do you want to tell us that I forgot to ask about? What should we know?
When I went to Albany Law School, I believe we had only one, maybe two female law professors, so we did not really have role models in law school, at least not my freshman year. I eventually family law with Professor Catherine Katz, so I had one female law professor during my 3 years at law school. I think my freshman year, Sandy Stevenson was the only woman on staff, and then maybe by my second, certainly by my third year, then Professor Katz was here. Whether there was anyone besides those two, I don't think so.
What prompted Tate Bisco to hire you?
You know, that's a difficult question. Why was I hired at the firm? Because I had a very interesting interview at the firm. I went in my second year as a law clerk at the firm. And my second and third year of law school, I worked almost every afternoon at the law firm. I went to school in the morning and in the evening because I felt that was the way to be able to really get a sense of what the practice of law was about, but also a way to get my foot in the door into a law firm. And I tried to be as conscientious as I could, and I think they became comfortable with me, and I was a hard worker, and we got along very well, so I think they were fairly pleased with my work, and they felt that I would be a good addition to the firm. And I was fortunate. I just started there right after I took the bar exam.
So it sounds like, if I understand you correctly, they weren't trying to make a statement. They had a good attorney, and they didn't view the gender as an impediment. So it doesn't sound like they were trying to hire a female, but they found a good lawyer, and the fact that you're female did not deter them from that. Is that what you're saying?
It sounds like I'm blowing my own horn, but I think they figured, oh, we have a hard worker, and she's willing to spend whatever time is necessary to get the job done. So I was fortunate and was offered the position.
I imagine, though, at some firms, even with the same qualities, I wouldn't have done the trick.
Well, that's why I said I was very lucky to join a firm where the gentlemen were willing to teach me the practice of law and spent a lot of time showing me the ropes and gave me opportunities to enter the courtroom, which a lot of firms weren't willing to do.
Thank you for listening to this edition of Amici. If you have a suggestion for a topic on Amici, call John Carr at 518-453-8669 or send him a note at jcaher@nycourts.gov. In the meantime, stay tuned.